You are Locked On Knicks, your daily podcast on the New York Knicks. Part of the Locked On Podcast Network. Your team, every day.
Welcome, everybody, to Locked On Knicks. I'm your host, James Marcina, and this is episode 190. On today's show, we're going to preview the 2017-18 New York Knicks. It's the Locked On Knicks, season preview. Knicks. Joining us is Jared Dubin, and we're going to break down the Knicks in, frankly, ways that you might even find uncomfortable. We're going to look at this thing from every angle, above, below, to the side, crisscross, catty corner. Going to be like Herman Melville talking about whales and Moby Dick, you know what I'm saying? He talked about every part of the whale and everything that it did. It was amazing. Truly amazing. And so is this episode of Locked On Knicks. Let's bring in very special guest, Jared Dubin.
Yes!
Welcome to the show, Jared. How you doing today?
I'm doing great, man. How are you?
I'm doing excellent. I'm ready to preview the Knicks. And I want to go about it from the top to the bottom. I want to start all the way at the top and work our way down. So let's talk about President of Basketball Operations Steve Mills, General Manager Scott Perry. On a scale of 1 to 10, with 1 being the gonzo treachery of garden succubus Isaiah Thomas, and 10 being the subtle, calming genius of Spurs architect R.C. Buford, what's your confidence level in this tandem?
Oh, man. I mean, my confidence level in them to do what, I guess? my confidence level in them to, like, build a Spurs-style organization is probably, like, a 2.
Okay.
My confidence level in them to be better than Phil Jackson is closer to, like, a 6.
Mm-hmm. How about to competently steer the Knicks for the next 2 to 3 years during their rebuilding phase without committing any massive faux pas that hamstring them for the next decade?
Yeah, that's tough, too. We don't know much about what Steve Mills is like or will be like in the top job. Basically, his 2 moves there so far have been, one, in my opinion, is very bad, signing Tim Hardaway Jr. for 4 years and $71 million. Mm-hmm. And one, in my opinion, was like probably, I wouldn't say it was a terrific move, but like they minimized the damage that could have been done with the Carmelo trade. So that was something that I think they did at least fairly well. Okay. Perry has a very good reputation around the league, but also has spent time in his last 2 stops at places that didn't have a whole lot of success, in Orlando and very briefly, obviously, in Sacramento. Mm-hmm. So it's difficult to stay there, too. Like, you know, he was in Oklahoma City before that. He was in Detroit for a while. And, you know, Orlando, obviously, they have been bad.
So, for sure. What would you look to see out of them this year in order to knock that confidence level up a couple points?
Be proactive in building for not just this year and next year, but for the timeline beyond that. And like whether or not it seems like they're filtering their decision making through the prism of what is best to maximize Kristaps.
Sure.
That's something that needs to be done, has needed to be done. Should be done, and if it's not done, then that's a surefire sign that they don't really know what they're doing.
Are you of the mindset that they gotta like trade every asset that's not part of the long term plan, or do you like keeping around 1 or 2 of these veterans? There's a lot of talk from a lot of Knicks fans about like anyone who is not like going to be here for the next 8 years, like get rid of them now. Where do you stand on that?
Yeah, I don't know if you necessarily need to get rid of them right now. Like, if there's guys that aren't going to be here over the long haul, but that you think can help Kristaps get to where he needs to go and help Frank get where he needs to go, I think it's fine to have those guys on the team. Like,
if they're nice complementary pieces to those guys' games.
Yeah, not necessarily that, but also that can just, like, teach them things about, okay, you know, where to be and what to do and how to be professionals and how to lead a team. Like, Jarrett Jack made the roster for the start of the season. I would say he's probably not going to be there beyond the first 12 games until Joakim Noah comes back from his suspension.
Right.
But I think it's good to have him there for those 12 games, because even if it's just for a month or a month and a half or whatever it is, I think there are things that he can teach Frank about being point guard and teach Frank about how to run an offense. You know, I know Ramon Sessions is partially here to do that as well, but my friend Devin Carpardian, who used to run the Nets blog, sure, Brooklyn Game, mentioned this when the Knicks picked up Jack. He is, if you could pick any player in the league to sign to not play at all, Jack would be right at the top of the list.
Oh, that's good
for
intel.
That kind of guy. And I agree. I think that it's good to have him on the team for as long as he's here. You know, there are other guys that are on the team that should be off the team. Joakim Noah, try to get him off the team as soon as possible.
What about someone like a Michael Beasley, who said that he's never gotten the opportunity and he should play every second of every game?
Yeah, look, you're not going to be able to trade him anyway, so it doesn't really matter. But I also do think, like, they need somebody on the wing to soak up possessions, because mm-hmm. you can't have Hardaway taking literally every shot
sure.
from the wing guys. And Beasley, if there's one thing he knows how to do, it's soak up possessions. Not necessarily going to do all that much good with them, but he can soak them up.
he's like the ShamWow of wing possessions.
Yeah. So, like, there are guys that I think, you know, obviously have more value on other teams than they do to the Knicks. Like a guy like Courtney Lee is much more valuable on a good team than he is on this Knicks team that is almost definitely going to be very bad.
Yeah.
You know, I think Lance Thomas is another guy that has more value to a good team than he does to the Knicks. Mm-hmm. But I also know they like both of those guys being in the locker room because of what they can bring for the young guys. And, you know, personally, I like those guys too, because they are actually sometimes willing to talk before the game, which is a big issue with most of the team most of the time. Or at least has been over the last few years. Last night I was in the locker room for a while, and there were a bunch of people in there. And Kylo Quinn was probably at the funniest level he's ever been in his life.
Oh, really? Wait, so do you think that this is particular to the Knicks, you're saying, not just NBA-wide?
They have oh, yeah. reluctant... Well, because
of the gulag NBA... at the Garden, or...?
No, it's more NBA players only have to talk pregame if they didn't talk at shoot-around.
Okay.
The Knicks always have everybody talk at shoot-around, which is in Westchester, which, you know, for someone like me, I live in Brooklyn and don't have a car. Mm-hmm. It's difficult for me to get to Westchester for a shoot-around in the morning. So I'm sure. almost never at Knicks shoot-around. I'm far more often at the opposing team's shoot-around, because I'm usually working on something about the other team anyway.
What time do they start their shoot-arounds?
It depends. It's usually pretty early, 10, 11, something like that.
Okay.
But, yeah, so for a lot of years, there would be, like, so for example, I can't remember the last time, other than after, somebody was fired, after Fisher was fired, that Carmelo talked before the game.
Interesting. But is
the Garden.
So, as someone who wants to get information out of them, that sounds frustrating, but that sounds like that could be a decent move for the franchise to, like, keep them focused. Not that the results have borne that out.
No, it's also, like, well within league rules. If you talk sure. at shoot-around, you do not have to talk at pregame. Some players will do both. Like, Kylo Quinn will sit in front of his locker. Kuz sits in front of his locker a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. When who was here that used to be there? I can't remember who it was. Aaron Aflalo would, like, come in before the game. And
Nick Legend.
If you caught him in the 30 seconds where he came in to grab his jersey out of his locker and then go to chapel, he would sit there and talk for 5 minutes. Like, there are guys that are willing to talk before the game. Like, Carmelo also would get treatment before the game a lot of the time.
Sure.
Kristaps gets treatment before the game a lot of the time. And then guys are, you know, obviously warming up or going to chapel or whatever it is. But a lot of the time, there's not very many guys in there. Cole Aldrich would be in there all the time, too, when he was here. But I forgot where I was going with this.
You were just, it was a long way of saying you like having around guys like a Courtney Lee and I forget who else
right.
you said, because they're willing to give some extra time before games.
Yeah, not so much even that, but like they like having those guys in the locker room around young guys,
right.
and I like them because they are nice guys to talk to, and sometimes they're pregame, which is you usually can't get guys in the Knicks pregame.
What do you think about signing Malik Rose to a 10-day to teach the guys the pull the chair maneuver?
I don't advise. I think he's an announcer.
Yeah, he's pretty erudite, I should say. I've liked the announcing I've caught from him, but
yeah,
I can't pretend to know his entire body of work. But he seems all right from what I've seen. So let's move down the chain a little bit to head coach Jeff Hornacek. After last year's disaster piece theater of shifting offensive and defensive schemes, I think we'd all like to see some consistency out of the head coach. However, the preseason saw a lot of tinkering with lineups, and he still has not publicly settled on a starting five, although he may have privately. I'm not really sure what's going on there. But do you think that Jeff Hornacek will settle on a well-defined, let's say, 10-man-ish rotation, and that the players will know their roles this year and know what's expected out of them?
No. I think it's going to be almost impossible just because of the way the roster was built.
Mm-hmm.
I think there are basically two guys that are guaranteed to start whenever they're healthy, in Kristaps and Hardaway.
Right.
And other than that, I think you're going to see a whole lot of different lineups, starting, off the bench, everything, just because there's no real separation between a lot of the guys at the other positions. Like, I think you'll see Kanter start games. I think you'll see Hernan Gomez start games. I don't know if you'll see many other centers start beyond that, but they do have like 14 more centers, so it's possible.
Roughly. Mm-hmm.
I think you will see Ron Baker start games. I think you'll see Session start games. I think you'll see Frank start games by the end of the year. And at the three, like, you'll see Courtney Lee, you'll see Lance Thomas, you'll see Beasley, you'll see McDermott. Like, you'll see maybe somehow Hardaway starts at the three one night. Like, I think you're gonna see a lot of different guys mixed through those spots while he tinkers looking for something that works, because honestly, most things are not going to work.
Would a better coach just settle on someone for the sake of consistency, or do you think there's something to be gained from kind of rewarding people bit by bit as they have better or worse performances throughout the season?
I don't know if it's more rewarding people for better or worse performances so much as it is trying to find something that works, because you do want to know which guys are going to, like I said, help Kristaps be his best self,
mm-hmm.
help cover up for, Hardaway's defensive weaknesses, help put him in position to get his shots offensively, because he's not a guy that is super good at creating his own looks. He's more of a catch and shoot and catch and finish kind of guy.
Mm-hmm.
So you need, whether it's guards or big men that are passing, to put him in good position to get his shots. So it's, you got to tinker to see what works, who belongs on the roster beyond this season. Basically, I would think the only guys that are guaranteed to be here beyond this year are KP, Tim, and Frank.
Right.
Beyond that, who knows? So I would not be surprised to see a lot of tinkering, and I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing to do a lot of tinkering, because when you are going to be as poor of a team as I expect them to be, the regular season should be used as sort of a lab experiment to see what works and what doesn't, who you like and who you don't, because that's the only purpose it serves if you're not going to do a whole lot of winning.
Sure. Drilling down on that idea a little bit, Hornacek mentioned having, one starting lineup that's more small ball with like Courtney Lee at the three, and having another starting lineup with someone bigger at that spot, whoever that might wind up being. Obviously, there's a glut of like these like kind of 3-4-ish guys, depending on the matchup. So I know you said you're okay with tinkering, but let's say like you had the right players that you liked. Do you like that approach of switching depending on your opponent, or do you think they should more try to make other teams play what they're doing? How do you feel about that?
Yeah, I'm not a fan of that. I call that the Woodson special. he loved to match up to the other team.
Yeah,
I am much more in favor of making the other team react to you.
Right.
That's just personal preference. There are some coaches that like to do that, some coaches that don't. But again, it's also it's hard to say that he should have settled on something by now when, you know, they have this wildly unbalanced roster with like six centers and six combo forwards and two guards on the whole roster.
Right.
And KP has been hurt and Frank has been hurt. And even like Noah is suspended, but he's also been like sick. So it's not even like you could have worked him into lineups. So they've been sitting like a different center every night just because there are too many of them to get minutes. Plus KP hasn't played, plus Frank hasn't played. So like, how are you supposed to settle on a lineup like that when you haven't had the full team for even one game in the preseason? So it's not necessarily that I blame him for that, but I also just don't like the idea of we're going to have different starting lineups based on who we're playing. That's just a personal preference. I think it's a bad idea.
Sure. Let's say you're a Vegas odds maker. You got to put an over-under on how many starting lineups we'll see this year. What number?
Over.
82?
Over.
Answers my question. One trend that has alarmed some people in the preseason is Hornacek playing a couple of his guys full quarters at a time. Where do you stand on that? Are you okay with that, or do you think that he needs to stagger his minutes a little bit better? Is this a preseason thing? What's going on there?
I don't know if it's a full season or preseason thing. I know some guys like the rhythm of playing the full quarter and then getting the break at the start of the second. Carmelo, for basically his whole career, has played the full first quarter, sat for the first 5-6 minutes of the second, and then played the rest of the way and done the same thing in the second half. And if you're a guy that has developed a rhythm like that over the course of your career, there is something to be said for keeping that kind of rhythm. But there are also guys that Rick Carlisle has done this with Dirk Nowitzki for years, takes him out like 6 minutes into the game, plays him, brings him back in like 3 or 4 minutes later, plays him for 6 minutes, sticks him for 3 minutes, and then plays him at the end of the half. That not only allows them to stagger their lineups in a bunch of different ways, it also lets him play a significant stretch of the first half against backups and really do a killing. And I suggested doing that with Kristaps. They did it a couple of years ago when Robin Lopez was there. I suggested doing it with Kristaps last year. It didn't really happen. I think it still would be a good idea to do it with Kristaps and do it for his whole career, because why not? If it works for Dirk, it can work for Kristaps.
Sure.
But I don't anticipate it necessarily happening, because most teams do like to have their best player play that full first quarter, sit for the first 5-6 minutes of the second, and then go the rest of the way.
So that'll be something interesting to watch as the season goes on. Now, when we talk about the upcoming season, you're necessarily talking about projections. You're projecting what you think is going to happen. And there's all kinds of predictive models out there that help people project what's going to happen in the upcoming season. So I was hoping we could talk a little bit about that. I mean, there's all kinds of them. There's Basketball References, simple projection system that gives individual players projections. 538 has their Carmelo. I'm just curious kind of like what else is out there. Which ones do you think do the best job? Maybe what are some of the differences between them?
So I like to just look at all of them and get like a holistic view of where the advanced stats community thinks teams are.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's important to note that most of these projection systems are, they wind up with a flatter win curve than the actual league does. Like, for example, I think the highest projection system has Golden State at like 65 wins or something like that.
Okay.
They are going to win more games than that. And like the lowest projection system has the team winning the fewest games at like 23, 24 wins. The worst team in the league is going to win fewer games than that.
Mm-hmm.
So the league winds up being more stratified than most of the projection systems have, because what they do is they run thousands of simulations and take the average of those simulations or the median of those situations, depending on which projection system you're talking about. And that obviously weeds out, quote unquote, outliers.
Sure.
For the most part.
Mm-hmm.
So it's important to know that, you know, the teams at the top will be better, the teams at the bottom will be lower or will be worse. The individual projection systems sort of depends on what you're looking for, but I think it's interesting to see also which systems are higher on which teams and why.
Mm-hmm.
Or if all of the systems are higher on one team or another, why. A couple of years ago, all of the systems were higher on the Celtics than, you know, the Vegas over-under, and it was basically because they just had no bad players. Like they didn't have any necessarily true superstars yet, but the lack of any bad players on the floor at any given time made the projection system think they were going to, you know, exceed their over-under by several wins, and I think that they did. So those kind of things are always something that I look for. I don't necessarily think any systems are better than any others. Mm-hmm. I know that, you know, the ESPN summer forecast has routinely beaten Vegas win projections because, you know, wisdom of the crowd tends to do that.
Right.
I know that everybody gets the angriest about NBA rank because it's from ESPN.
Sure.
I tend to think that people fixate too much on the actual number that a player is ranked as opposed to, like, you know, the general
tier
placement within the league hierarchy.
Yeah.
Like, is there a huge difference between the 64th best player and the 45th best player in the league?
Interesting, so. You chose that number 64.
Yeah. and I think, you know, Carmelo was like in the 40s in other ranking systems, which is,
right,
you know, closer to the truth, but not by all that much. It's just not that big of a difference.
Yeah.
Like, I think it's obviously he is not the 64th best player. He's better than that. But it's also like, it's just not that far off. It's like 2% off. Who cares?
Yeah, that's where I fell on that. I was like, all right, you know, putting Lonzo ahead of him, like, a little ridiculous having not set foot on an NBA court yet. But is it, like, so egregious? In my opinion, definitely not. Yeah, but
it's, you know, so those are more, like, I admire the work that goes into them. Like, especially, you know, so at both CBS and SI, they do explanations of why the players are where they are. You know, with ESPN, it's more just like blurbs. And I know that's because it's not just done by one or two people. It's done by hundreds of voters, and it's just an algorithm spits out wherever the players land. So you can't really have, you know, hundreds of different voters do commentary on why players landed where they did, because we didn't even place them there. They just wound up there based on everybody's votes. With CBS and SI, it's a much smaller crew, and their crew, you know, whether it's, you know, Matt Warren, James Herbert, or Rob Mahoney and Ben Golliver, they do a really good job of explaining why players landed where they did. So I always enjoy that aspect of it more than where the players are actually ranked.
Yeah. Looking at these predictive systems as a whole, do they tell us anything interesting about this year's Knicks, or it's just sort of what we expect in this, like, low 30s win range?
I think it's what we expect. Like, their over-under before the Carmelo trade, I think, was 30.5, and that's where most of the projection systems had them, in the low 30s. The over-under dropped, I think, to 27.5 after the trade, and I would imagine that, you know, most projection systems run since then probably have them somewhere close to there. I think that's a pretty good over-under. It sort of depends whether Kristaps misses his annual 15 games or not.
Right.
If he misses more than that, I would say it's a definitive under. But that's not the worst thing in the world. Like, who cares how many games they win this year? As long as Kristaps get better and Frank looks good, and, like to me, that's pretty much it. I guess it would be nice if Hardaway didn't look like a total disaster, like Noah did after he signed his bad contract.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, like, at least he's young, so.
So let's do a very simple prediction here. When will the Knicks get their first win of the season?
And I'd have to look at the actual schedule.
I've got it in front of me, so we can run through the first like 10 or so. Hopefully it's before then. They open at Oklahoma City.
Yeah, they're not winning that one.
Then they are home against Detroit.
I think there's a chance. Like, Detroit is better than them, but Detroit is also not good.
Right.
So, like, there's a chance they win that game, but I would say it's less than 50%.
All right. Then they're at Boston.
Yeah, they're not winning that one either.
Then they're home against Brooklyn.
I think, looking at the schedule, they better hope that's their first win if they don't beat the Pistons, because they're not winning the next few games after that either.
Yeah, then it's at Cleveland, home against Denver, home against Houston. Then Phoenix comes in. They've got a nice homestand, at least. They got, what is it, 5 games in a row? Denver, Houston, Phoenix. Indiana and Charlotte.
Yeah, I remember talking to someone the other day actually about this, like when they were going to get their first win, and they said, like, if they still haven't won after that Rockets game and then lose to the Suns, they asked me, like, does Hornacek get fired? And I said no, because if he gets fired, then the interim coach has to be Kurt Rambis,
yeah.
And that can't happen.
I don't think, short of him hitting on his players' wives and girlfriends, I don't think he gets fired in season.
I'm going to no comment that one.
Let's keep it moving. Let's talk about the players. That's, after all, what this team is made up of. And we're going to start at the top of the hierarchy with Kristaps Porzingis. In your opinion, how's he going to handle being the guy this year in a post-Carmelo Anthony world?
I am not worried about him being the guy from a standpoint of, like, a face of the franchise kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
He will handle that very well. He has basically already handled it very well.
Mm-hmm. Agree.
And, like, I'm not worried about him at all from a personality or dealing with the media or dealing with, you know, the weight of expectations of the fans standpoint. That's, mm-hmm. I think he's going to be fine on that front. The on-court transition, I think, will be more difficult for him this season, not necessarily because of any failings of his own, but because of the way the roster is set up. There are like 14 centers on the team, so he's not going to play the position that I think would give him the most chance for success offensively.
Right.
And he also is, you know, he can do some creating of his own shot. It's obviously not his primary strength,
mm-hmm.
but he can do some of it. But he's also a big guy. So even if he's going to create his own shot, he needs somebody to get him the ball. And the Knicks are going to have one of the, you know, two or three worst point guard situations in the league, if not the worst point guard situation in the league this year, just based on the level of guys that they have to create looks for others. So it's going to be very difficult to get Kristaps easy shots. Things are going to be difficult on that front for him this year. So I think that the transition for being the focal point of the offense can be a little bit more difficult than you would like this season.
So you mentioned kind of before not minding if the Knicks lose some games, and obviously from an organizational standpoint of acquiring valuable assets, that makes a ton of sense. They're you know, a couple years away at least from like serious contention. Do you have any concern about like the psyche of Kristaps and being like year three of just like rock bottom? Do you think that will affect him, or do you think if like Scott and Steve do their jobs, they can talk to him and explain what's going on and give him confidence in a direction of a team?
Yeah, I think you always have to worry about so much losing affecting a guy's psyche.
Yeah.
But it's also a matter of how you're losing. If you're losing, like, just because your team isn't as good, but you're playing hard and you're competing and you're, like, in games for the most part, then, like, it's understandable if you're losing just because the talent's not there. If you're getting blown off the floor by 15, 20 points every night, that's, you know, that's just demoralizing. And it's way more difficult to deal with.
If you're going down by 15 in the first 5 minutes of the first quarter.
Yeah, and I do think there's a danger of that with this team to a certain extent, especially early on in the year. When you have, you know, Oklahoma City, Boston, Cleveland, Houston within the first, like, 2 weeks of the season.
Yeah.
That's, like, you could very quickly have things spiral against all of those teams, and that's obviously not good to have.
You talked about his creating a little bit. You know, he's got quite the majestic crossover dribble. Is that something you want to see more out of him, or should he eliminate that entirely with his huge wingspan and people being able to pick that out of his pocket? Where do you stand on Kristaps, dribble drive creator?
Yeah, this is something that I actually have talked about on a couple of podcasts recently, randomly.
Mm-hmm. you're saying my questions are garbage, Jared? Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm saying it's the thing that
it's on the mind.
Obviously a good question because it's on a lot of people's mind.
Yeah.
His crossover works better than it should for how slow it is.
Right.
Like, it's obviously very slow, but he gets down super low when he does it. And because he's so big, he winds up, like, 3 feet away from the guy that he crosses over whenever he does it. So it just works really well. and I think it's a good move for him.
Yeah, okay.
You know, especially when he goes into a jumper, because, like, he does get and rise up pretty quickly after that cross. So it's I like the move. I know he's got that other move where he sort of like dribbles himself into a half Dirk,
right.
Also, which is another good move for him. You know, you want to see him develop counters off of those as well.
For
and
sure.
That's the big thing you're looking for, you know, in terms of his off the dribble creating this
and
year.
He probably needs some good spacing to make that crossover work, right? Surround him with some shooters, clear out a little bit because he covers a lot of ground.
Shooters like Enes Kanter and Kyle O'Quinn.
What about Dougie McBuckets and Tim Hardaway Jr. shooting 40% from beyond the arc this preseason?
Yeah, it's look, if you can get those guys in the court together, you're going to give up about 172 points a game, but at least you'll score like 115.
One last Kristaps question before we keep moving. As someone who has dealt with hip injuries yourself, I'm assuming that you are now an expert in all matters of the hip. Are you at all worried about the hip injury that Kristaps is dealing with in the preseason?
Yeah, I don't know what his hip injury is, so it's hard to know how worried to be about it. But I also know that any hip injury is awful to deal with because it's the hinge of your entire body. So you never want to have somebody dealing with a hip injury.
Yeah. The next season could hinge on that hinge, one might say.
Yes.
If
it's just like a hip flexor strain, that's not quite as big of a deal. If he's dealing with a labrum injury or something like that, is obviously a much bigger deal.
Okay, so let's talk about another presumed pillar of the New York Knicks, Frank Ntilikina. I want to start right at the top with the most important thing about Frank Ntilikina, and that is that I am not a huge fan of Frankie Smokes as a nickname. I know that you are a big fan, so I'd like you to make a case, both for me and the listeners, for Frankie Smokes as the appropriate Frank Ntilikina nickname.
First of all, the fact that you're not a fan of the nickname makes me not a fan of you.
Now back it up with some reason and some research.
So, first of all, let's tick off some of these other nicknames that people are trying to use, which are just terrible. Like, people keep tweeting at me, like, Frank Nitty is a nickname people want to use.
Bad.
That is fucking garbage.
Garbage.
Like, first of all, what is a Nitty? Second of all, the T in his name doesn't get pronounced, so why are you using it in a nickname?
Yeah.
Third of all, it just sounds terrible. So
I hate that. Yeah.
Get that out of here. If anybody uses it, we ain't friends no more, as Charles Barkley would say. second of all, the French press? No. It sounds like food. It's like you're trying to make a grilled cheese or something.
That's a nickname for a style of play, not for the player. It's when he engages in the full court press. The French press.
Yeah, no, that's like terrible. I don't like that either.
Boo.
The only one I have liked outside of Frankie Smokes is the French Prince.
That's decent.
But how can you call him the French Prince when there is both a guy named Prince in the league in Taurean Prince from the Hawks and an actual Prince in the league in Luke Bamute? Like, you can't call him the Prince when there is an actual Prince in the NBA.
Okay.
So none of those work. Second of all, fourth of all, or whatever the hell I'm on right now, Frankie Smokes sounds like an old-timey mobster that sold cigarettes off the back of a truck.
It does.
And if you're playing in New York, that's about as cool of a, you know, source for a nickname as you can get. Like, if you imagine Henry Hill selling those cigarettes off the back of a truck in the start of Goodfellas, you can imagine that the guy that actually did that was a guy that people called Frankie Smokes. And I think that that is really cool.
I think Frank's just too pure for that nickname. I don't have a favorite right now. I just think we're not quite there yet. Like, I think we're trying to make Fetch happen a little bit.
I think that you're wrong.
Listen, Jared, you've never been more wrong about anything in your life. But
I've got Jason Concepcion and basically now the entire Ringer on my side on this one.
You know,
so I think we're going to be able to make it happen, and it's great. And look, there was something like he likes a certain nickname. I don't even remember which one it was, because you know why? It doesn't matter. You don't get to choose your nickname.
That is true.
This is like when Kevin Durant somehow got people to stop calling him one of the best nicknames ever, Slim Reaper, and tried to be like, nah, call me the Servant. Like, that is nonsense. Like,
Slim Reaper is good.
Get to choose your nickname.
Oh, yeah, it's just like, we had the same thing going when Kristaps joined the league, and there were all these nicknames. I just wind up calling him Crispy, and I don't even know, like, it just comes out of me. I'm not saying it's good. I think nicknames have to be a little less forced. That's kind of, like, where I come from, but...
Yeah, look, you definitely can't just force one to happen. Like, I tried to make a 3-6 Latvia happen for a little while.
Which is clever, I like that.
It came from one of my Twitter followers, I can't remember who.
It's a good, like, written piece thing to call someone, but, like, if you're watching a game and you're not going to be like, 3-6 Latvia, like, after he has a putback dunk or something, you know?
Right. It's also, like, that's exactly what I agree.
Fair enough.
But people have basically just wound up calling him KP because it's easy.
Yeah.
But I am very anti initial nicknames. Like, if we wind up calling Frank FN, I'm going to murder somebody.
That's bad.
Not good. I do think Frankie Smokes or Frankie Nicotine, as Jason likes to call him, I think those are both really good, and I hope that they catch on.
All I want to say, and then we'll move on, is that just because something has consensus doesn't mean it's right. Donald Trump won an election, for example.
There was no consensus there.
Fair. You know what? Stop poking holes in my airtight arguments. Let's talk about Frank on the court. This year, will he be able to make people stop complaining that he was drafted ahead of Dennis Smith Jr., if ever? Or do you think that that was a huge blunder by the Knicks?
I don't necessarily think it was a huge blunder. I definitely think people are going to complain about it no matter what, though.
Yeah. Do you think just because of the style of their play and the differences and Dennis Smith being a more explosive athlete, that kind of bickering will just sort of last throughout their career?
Yeah, that definitely is going to play into it. It's hard for it not to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, especially right away, because Smith is going to be in such a good position to succeed based on the opportunity that he had. Like, he's going to start right away in Dallas. Rick Carlisle has basically already said that that's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And he has, like, the best pick-and-pop partner of all time. And he has a really good pick-and-roll partner. And he's just going to be in great position to succeed right away. So it's going to be one of those things where he comes in and he's just going to be able to do the things that he's best at right away.
Yeah.
And it's going to be especially annoying for Knicks fans that really wanted them to draft him, just because you're going to be in position to succeed right away. And, you know, the Knicks are basically not going to be able to put anybody in all that good of a position to succeed right away because of the way the roster is built. And Frank also has gotten, unfortunately, off to a start where he has played, like, what, 12 minutes?
Something like
that.
With
the Knicks so far. Because he got injured in the first summer league practice, didn't play at all over the summer, and he got injured, I think, in the first preseason game. So he really hasn't played at all since then. So it's not like he's going to come in and just start and play 25-plus minutes a game right away. I think they said yesterday, like, he's going to practice in full today and should be ready for the start of the season. So I think he will play in the opener. I don't know how much, and I think it's almost definite that he'll come off the bench. But, you know, he's going to have to work his way up into the starting lineup and playing a whole bunch of minutes every night. That's not necessarily a bad thing.
Sure, I agree.
It's good to have that be the case sometimes. But it's also, I could imagine it being frustrating for people that wanted them to see them pick another guy.
What does a successful season for Frank Ntilikina look like to you?
I think it's one where he establishes himself as definitively the best point guard on a roster, where the other point guards on the roster are not any good.
Yeah.
If that can't happen, that's troubling to me. You know, I want to see him affect the game defensively because that's going to be his strength right away.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to see what he can do off the dribble. You know, that's something that's not necessarily considered his strength so far. So it would be nice if he could show that he could do a little bit more than that. And to me, like, I just want to see one successful pick and pop between him and Kristaps by the end of the season.
So speaking of the, you know, I don't know if glut is the word you can use of point guards, because there's a lot of not good ones. But they've got sort of a lot of options with Sessions looking to get some time, Frank looking to get some time, Ron and even like maybe Tim and Courtney spot minutes. You know, a little bit of Jarrett Jack before Noah comes back. Who do you think is going to lead the team in assists per game this year? And how many assists do you think that's going to be?
I think it depends if Sessions is healthy throughout the season. I think he's a pretty good bet to lead them in assists if he's healthy, just because it seems like he's probably going to get the first shot at starting based on the way they've lined up throughout the preseason. And that means he's going to be playing with Kristaps, so he's going to have the best opportunity for assists.
Yeah.
So I would expect him to then lead them in that. If he's not healthy, then, like, who knows? You might lead the team in assists.
Answers that question. Let's talk about Billy Hernan Gomez. There is a hashtag logjam of centers. We've put the number at somewhere around 14 to 15 on the roster. Do you think that he's going to regress this year, given that logjam? And do you think Hornacek is making a mistake by, it looks like he's going to start Enes Kanter over him?
I do think he's making a mistake starting Enes Kanter over him.
Okay.
I think that you have this guy who came over from Europe as a 23-year-old rookie and was way better than anybody could have expected. And he is on one of the best non-rookie scale, non-max contracts in the league. And it's insanity to park him on the bench behind one of the more overpaid players in the league who, you know, if we're being honest, probably doesn't have much of a future with the team. It doesn't make sense to me at all. I don't think it's a good idea in really any way whatsoever.
What if Billy still gets significant minutes? Like, let's say he gets a minimum of, like, 25 a night. And the other thing that I wonder about is, like, a locker room situation. Kanter seems like a really good guy. He's not going to complain or whatever. But is it weird to the team? A lot of these guys are not necessarily part of the core. They want to go out there. They want to win every night. Is it weird to them if they see someone like Kanter producing, let's say, like, you know, his per 36, he averaged about, like, 8 more points than Hernan Gomez last year. I know that you know, he's a couple years older.
Was Kanter at 24 points per 36 minutes last year?
Yeah.
Billy was at 16.
Yeah, he was. So
good
if,
for him. But yeah. Also, look.
And I know that doesn't say everything, but I'm just like, you know, semi-hypothetically speaking, could the locker room be annoyed if they see someone who doesn't produce as much offensively? I know there's defense to talk about, although I'm not as sold on Billy's defense, but could that factor into a decision to start someone like Kanter over someone like Billy, even though clearly Billy, you know, has a much better contract, and so it would be better for the Knicks if they were able to develop him? But what do you think about that?
I don't think so, also because, like, Kanter is just, like, a genial guy that is okay coming off the bench.
Sure.
Like, you look at it, he's started, what, like, 20% of the games in his career or something like that.
Yeah.
He's also had his most success when coming off the bench.
Right.
Dominating backup big men. If he's in the starting lineup, he can't dominate backup big men.
So if you put yourself... keep going.
I think with the kind of success that Billy had down the stretch last season, starting next to Kristaps, I don't think it makes sense to bring him back off the bench again, especially because, like, he's Kristaps' best friend, and you got to do everything that you can to make Kristaps happy, and I would imagine that starting next to Billy every night would do that also.
If you had to put yourself in Hornacek's head, which perhaps could be a scary proposition, why would you say he's doing this?
I think that right now they probably consider Kanter the better offensive player and more likely to draw the attention of defenses. You know, I think that him and Billy have similar offensive skill sets. Kanter's is more advanced right now because he's 3 years older and has been in the league for 3 or 4 more years. But I also think that if you want Hernan Gomez to be the best Hernan Gomez that he can be, that, you know, he's got to play, and he's got to play against starters. Like, I don't know if he's necessarily going to be ever a guy that is a 30-plus minute a game player and closes games.
Right.
I think it's more like a guy that, you know, I compared it to this, like an offensive version of Robin Lopez, where he starts and plays like 25 minutes a night but doesn't play down the stretch of games just because, you know, teams generally are going smaller these days and he's not going to be able to deal with that defensively. But he can soak up, you know, half the time of a game at the center spot and give you good offensive production. And I think Kanter can do that to a certain extent too, but not at nearly as good a value. And, you know, I think that there's some merit to wanting to put him in position to succeed, to see if you could trade that second year of his contract, because it's almost definite that he's going to pick up that, yeah, whatever it is, $19.8 million option. But I think that him being in the best position to succeed involves him dominating bench bigs. You know, that's just my opinion. So,
okay. So it's a combination of putting everyone in a position to succeed and smart roster construction, you would say.
Yeah.
Okay.
And just like, I don't think it makes sense to not really sideline Billy, but like, he did really well as the starter down the stretch of last season. Yeah. I don't think it's right to send him back to the bench just because he traded for a guy that does the same things as him but makes more money.
It doesn't bother me quite as much as it does you, although I think all your points make perfect sense. I will flip a shit, though, if Kyle O'Quinn is the first big off the bench. But that is just not going to do it for me. Let's talk about another stated member of this young core, Ron Baker. Do you think he's going to live up to the massive mid-level exception that he signed this offseason? There's a large group of fans who think the Knicks made a huge mistake in giving him that contract. Does that include you?
I think it's whenever you consider somebody part of your young core, what you should definitely do is give them a one-year deal with a player option. That definitely makes a ton of sense, because that way, if they outperform the deal like you expect them to, then they get to opt out and you can pay them even more. Which, you know, is always a good idea.
They're a players' organization, Jared. You know what I mean? They're doing the right thing for their guys.
That makes a ton of sense. So I think it was super good that they did that.
That being said, how do you expect him to perform this year? Do you think it will match that, like, $4.1 million that he's getting? Do you think his defense is going to, you know, be solid in the backup role? Is his shot going to come around? What do you see there?
Yeah, I am not nearly as big a fan of his as the team seems to be.
Uh-huh.
I know that there are many teams that are not as big a fan of him as the Knicks seem to be as well. I don't understand why they think he's like already a clear positive defender. I don't think he really defended very well at all last season. You know, maybe there's things they saw in practice or elsewhere that led them to believe he's better than what he showed on the court, but he did not shoot well, he did not pass well, he did not defend well for the most part last season. I was very surprised they gave him that much money. Like, if they brought him back on a minimum contract, okay, fine, that would have made a ton of sense. Giving him the money they did, I don't get it. Yeah, giving him the years they did, you know, the way the contract is structured, I definitely don't get it.
Yeah, that's indisputably bizarre. That doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, look, okay. It would be great if he proves me wrong.
Mm-hmm.
I just didn't particularly get anything about that signing.
So you're saying there's a chance that he will develop into a all-star player. That's what I'm hearing.
Yes.
Yep. Tim Hardaway Jr., another guy who signed what many people believe to be a very questionable contract, I think has looked pretty solid in preseason offensively, anyway. Some might even say mad decent. Do you think, I kind of think I know the answer to this that I'm going to get from you, but do you think his production will justify his contract this year, or at any point throughout the contract?
No. I think the big thing you want to do when you're an NBA team is figure out a way to get surplus value from a contract.
Yeah.
I think there's almost no way they get surplus value from the contract. Best case scenario, he lives up to it. And even if that happens, he opts out after 3 years and then you got to pay him again. He was like fine in Atlanta as the third or fourth offensive option, you know, in the second or third option on the perimeter with, you know, point guards that knew how to put him in position to succeed, and, you know, Paul Millsap there and Al Horford there for much of his time, and only getting on the court when he played passable defense because Budenholzer wouldn't play him if he didn't. And, like, let's not pretend that his defense was any better than passable. Like, this idea somehow that he is now a good defender, it has zero basis in reality and needs to stop being talked about, like, ever. But, like, again, he wasn't going to get on the court if he didn't play passable defense in Atlanta. That's not true in New York. He's getting on the court no matter what.
Right.
You know, so yeah. Okay. I'm not sure. Like, I think it's an almost definite, especially because he's going to have more offensive responsibility. His defense almost has to regress from where it was. And when you're regressing from passable, that means you are now not passable defensively. I think he's going to struggle to find shots sometimes because he's not the best creator off the dribble for himself. Like, he's a good finisher around the rim. But when you're playing 14 centers, it's more difficult to finish around the rim. And when you don't have point guards to set you up on the perimeter, it's more difficult to shoot from three.
Uh-huh.
And it's not like he's been an elite three-point shooter in Atlanta. He's basically been an average one for a two-guard. So, look, do I think that he's going to be an epic disaster on that contract, Joakim Noah style? Probably not, just because he's young enough and mostly healthy enough that, you know, it's almost impossible to be that much of a disaster of a contract. But it's like, to me, there's almost no chance that, like, there is no chance that he exceeds the value. And even if he does provide excess value, all that means is that you only got him for 3 years and he opts out. Okay. So even in the best case scenario, it's not very good. But to me, the actual best case scenario is he makes it look fine. And even that, I think, has a relatively low chance of happening based on the skill set he has and the fact that the Knicks are not constructed to put him in success position to take best advantage of it.
Let's talk about another young shooting guard, Damian Dotson, drafted in the second round out of Houston. I think he's impressed some people with his shooting touch, some of his aggressive defense. What are your expectations for him this season?
Yeah, I think he might just be good.
Yeah.
He can shoot, obviously. We saw that at Houston, and we've seen it in the preseason as well. And it looks like he can defend twos and threes, too.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I think he might just be a good player, and I hope that they can find minutes for him. Like, it's a crowded wing rotation, not necessarily with guys that are terrific players or anything.
Do you think he could usurp Courtney Lee at some point in the pecking order, or is that out of the question as long as he's around?
Yeah, I don't know if he'll usurp Courtney, but I think that if Courtney gets traded, he's a good candidate to step into that role.
Sure. Is it sort of a bummer to see him with so much promise and then have someone like Tim Hardaway with that large contract ahead of him? Or is that just like, whatever, that's a good problem to have? Like, you'd rather have too many people for too few spots if they're decent.
I think it's more, I'm not sure how to phrase this. I think that they could be, like, fine playing with each other.
You think so? I wasn't sure about his defense against threes, but you think he can hold his own there?
Yeah, I mean, he's got a super long wingspan. He's like 6'6 with a 6'9 wingspan, which is pretty good. So I'm not super worried about him on that front. I think he can do, and plus, like, he's 205, but he looks like he weighs like 215.
Yeah, he looks like he's got an NBA body. He's a little bit older, though, right? He's like 22?
Yeah, I think he's 23.
23, yeah.
But yeah, I'm not worried about him defensively. Cool. I think he'll be able to hold his own there.
I want to round up the last couple guys I want to talk about. Do you expect anything out of Kuz this year, or is he just out of the rotation? His time is come and gone. Like, that's kind of it.
I don't know what to expect there, honestly.
Yeah. He looked good in a Eurobasket. He looked like he was gaining some confidence, maybe coming back after playing in the NBA. He's like, oh, I can hang. But that's a different, you know,
playing
different vibe.
Against the slightly lower level athletes in Eurobasket than in the NBA. Like, he's got a nice offensive skill set, but he doesn't have it defensively against NBA athletes.
Yeah.
It's just not there. So it's difficult to get him minutes against anything but bench guys. And look, that's fine. They just also have a lot of that kind of player at this point, like the 3-4 hybrid type.
What about, speaking of, unless you have more Kuz thoughts, but I was wondering, I was wondering what you thought about Dougie McBuckets. He's got a much cheaper contract than Enes Kanter. I'm wondering if you think there's any chance the Knicks are looking at him for after this season, or is this just kind of a one-year tryout for another team and they just needed him to make salaries match in the Carmelo deal?
Yeah, I think that there's a chance that he winds up sticking around. I don't think they're going to extend him for sure.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the deadline is tomorrow. It's Tuesday. It's the start of the season.
Uh-huh.
That's not going to happen. But I think that if he sort of separates himself from the rest of the 3-4 types on the roster, then yeah, there's a chance that he winds up sticking around because you can never have enough shooting.
Right. I feel that. Let's close out the player section, and then I've just got a couple of odds and ends questions to end the pod. But I want to talk briefly about Beasley. Can we expect any sort of solid production out of him in some limited minutes, or is he just more of a tall Brandon Jennings, maybe talented player making weird decisions on the court?
He's definitely a weird Brandon Jennings.
Yeah. I was like, oh, that vibe is familiar. What am I feeling? And then it was the Brandon Jennings tingle a little bit.
Yeah, I do think that I think that he is going to maybe provide the most value of this year's offensive acquisitions just because the Knicks don't have anybody on the wing that can create their own shot for the most part.
Yeah.
And he's not creating necessarily good shots, but he can create shots on the wing, you know,
uh-huh.
almost exclusively for himself,
yeah.
but he can do it. And they need that kind of guy.
Yeah.
So I would not be surprised if he was actually like not good, but like provided a nice bit of value for them just because he brings something that they don't have elsewhere on the roster.
Yeah. One thing that surprised me about him is his rebounding. He's gotten after it pretty well. I didn't know that.
He's also just been pretty
game.
Good for what he is the last couple of years. So I think he's going to be fine. Like, he's definitely going to be fucking weird. and people are going to be like, what is wrong with this dude a lot of the time. But I think he'll be fun.
Yeah, I think we're going to enjoy watching him this year, for better or worse. I got a couple grab bag questions to close out the show. Which Clyde phrase will we hear the most this year? Posting and toasting, weaving and achieving, the Nick with the knack, maybe something a little less positive. Any predictions there?
Yeah, definitely. Or I guess you could hear positive stuff, but it's mostly going to be like from the other side.
Yep.
Spinning and winning.
I think maybe Matador D could lead.
Matador D for sure.
Yeah.
You're going to hear a whole lot of swishing and dishing for opposing point guards.
Yeah.
That's
candidate.
We'll hear that a lot. I would say swishing and dishing we'll hear the most, but it's mostly going to be for the other side.
I like that call. Will we see any in-season moves this year of any sort of significance? Will Kyle Quinn be moved? Courtney Lee, Lance Thomas, some of these guys we talked about. Dream scenario, Joakim Noah. That's obviously not going to happen. But what do you see there?
Yeah, I think that there's definitely going to be an in-season move at some point just because there almost has to be.
Yeah.
I don't know who it'll be. I think that Courtney and Kyle are both good candidates to get moved at some point.
Mm-hmm.
They've definitely had teams interested in both of them. I think if they had a deal that they liked, maybe one of them would have been moved already. You know, it just sort of depends what they're looking for.
Yeah, okay. So we've heard the Knicks discuss pretty openly this idea that, you know, they're more interested in the process and developing players and not necessarily judging by wins or losses. I think this is the most openly they've talked about tanking. So I'm wondering what's the most tanktastic thing the Knicks will do this year. Will it be like a fake injury or sitting healthy players for rest? Or will they play it more just kind of straight and let the, you know, cards fall where they may, given the talent level on the roster?
I think Kristaps will sit out the last 5 or 6 games with a phantom injury.
Okay, I like that call. Now, I want to close the show by doing something a little crazy. I'm overselling it now. I want you to name a favorite musical artist. Just follow me here. We're going somewhere with this. Now, ideally, this would be like your A number one, but I know that's kind of like an impossible task. So, for a lot of people, I could be like, I can't name my favorite. But like, what's like a favorite rapper or band or something like that?
Jadakiss.
All right, now, I want you to name something from Jadakiss's world, whether it's a song or a moment in his career or a legal trouble or anything, that would best describe this year's Knicks team?
That would best describe this year's Knicks team.
Yeah. It could be like his worst song ever.
No. Well, a lyric. I'll just say, the song "I Don't Care."
So is that your approach to the season, or the front offices, or the players?
Yes.
Jared, I want to thank you very much for joining me on this Knicks season preview and for injecting a dose of, some might say, needed realism after my daily homer display. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. And, you know, I still get the tweet notifications for the Locked On Knicks account. Apparently people are missing my – somebody described it as like a nasal sarcasm.
Oh, my God.
And I very much appreciate being described that way.
Yeah. Thanks, guys. Keep the feedback coming. We both love it. So that was fun, huh? Huh? Always a good time speaking with Locked On Knicks legend Jared Dubin. Hope you guys enjoyed. Hope you guys are looking forward to a season of growth and progress and hope. I think Jared's ready to fast forward, but not me. I'm ready to see what happens, you know? That's not fair. I'm putting words in Jared's mouth there. That's not fair. I take it back. But I don't take back my love for you guys. Thank you for listening. I may have said that before, and I'll keep saying it, because I appreciate it. This is Locked On Knicks. Peace!